Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Actually, I believe it was big swinging dicks. So there was obviously an overexcited imagination on the part of some, I would suggest.
Because if he wants to know what misogyny looks like in modern Australia, he doesn't need a motion in the House of Representatives. He needs a mirror.
I love the mansplaining. I'm enjoying it.
What's mansplaining, Senator?
Welcome to In the House and In the Senate. I'm Alicia Aiken-Radburn, and we're talking to women in Australian politics about who they are, what they do, and why it matters. Sophie Kotsis is the Labor member for Canterbury in New South Wales. She's been in New South Wales Parliament for over 10 years and served in the Legislative Council from 2010 to 2016 before moving to the Legislative Assembly. Sophie is the daughter of Greek migrants, mother to Cassandra and George, and was the first Greek Australian woman to be elected to New South Wales Parliament. Before entering politics, Sophie was a hospitality worker at Sydney Airport, where she became involved in unionism and increasingly the Labor Party. Sophie was also my first boss in politics. I worked for her as a media and policy assistant for 2 years. It was a fantastic first experience for me diving into the world of politics, thanks to Sophie's passion to make change, empathy, and depth of experience. Soph, it's been a while between chats. As I mentioned, I've at the top of this episode, you're my first boss. You were my real entry point into the world, crazy world of politics. And the question that I ask everyone at the beginning of each episode is, what does your day look like today?
Alicia, I'm very, very proud of you and know that I'm so happy what you're doing. It's fantastic, and you're getting out there, and it's great to see your career progress. And I am very proud of all the people that have worked for me, because I've seen that they're very successful. So my day starts probably at about 4:45, 5 o'clock every morning. And because I'm a shadow minister in a 10-year opposition, I have to and I make sure that I check the media. And if there is a story, if there's obviously stories that I've got in the paper, make sure that we get onto radio, make sure that the Labor Party is putting their they're advocating for the people of New South Wales. But then I have to organise, get the kids ready. My husband helps out a lot. And then I drive them to school, so get them ready. I'm not a very good, I'm not very good at sort of making breakfast and doing all of that. So that's pretty,
you're busy.
That's pretty bad. And then, yeah, taking them to school. And then, you know, I could be at a citizenship ceremony. I could be having a whole lot of meetings in the office. I could be traveling across the regions. So my day, there's no one day that's the same. And, but as well, I just also have to manage my own health as well. So I try and get in a walk or try and get in a swim, and probably yoga, like, which I have to since my breast cancer diagnosis. So I try and fit it all in. And then in between, my mum is always calling me to go past and pick up food because she worries that the kids aren't eating well. And so, yeah, so that's kind of the day.
It takes a village. That's what they say.
It sure does.
Sophie, you mentioned your breast cancer diagnosis. Now, your road as a parliamentarian has not been smooth. At that point, it was 2018, you handed over your Women, Ageing, Disability Services shadow portfolios at the time, and you went through months of surgery, chemo and radiotherapy. Can you tell me about that fight? And I mean, the fight itself, but also your decision not to resign, and you came back stronger than ever at the 2019 election and you took the seat of Canterbury once more.
Well, it's been, yes, that's right. Like, as you know, you worked for me when I was in the New South Wales Upper House and in those early years of wilderness opposition. And that was, and we can talk about more about that, but as you were there with the by-election in Canterbury when Linda resigned to go into Barton to be elected the member for Barton, and she's doing an amazing job. And so come beginning of 2018, and I went for a scan, mammogram and an ultrasound, and then biopsy, and then I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And it was the most traumatic feeling ever that I've experienced in my life so far. And it was a real turning point in my life. And I questioned mortality. I questioned, you know, a lot of things. You know, I've got two little kids, a beautiful family, my parents, my brother, you know, so it was devastating. And so, yes, it was, yeah, just, you know, months and months. But at the same time, I wanted to get really well. And so I'm very grateful to my colleagues, to my parliamentary colleagues, to, you know, at the time, our general secretary, the leader of our party at the time, who, and for any workplace, you need to have supportive people. So you're not constantly thinking about work, so you can focus on getting better and coming back and contributing. And that's what, you know, what I wanted to do. And also, more importantly, my staff who held the office together and, you know, who just went above and beyond. And I have a debt of gratitude to them. And of course, my family.
I do want to go back to what initially got you involved in politics, but just while we were on this, how do you feel like that experience coloured how you interacted with your job and the meaning of your job to you?
I think that with going through that process, the treatment process, I think it put a lot of perspective, and it also made me you reflect a lot about the decisions that you've made, and I questioned a lot of the decisions that I made, and I guess the frustration of going through the treatment at the same time having small children and then questioning, you know, and then the mortality aspect. I think that as days went by and I started to get a lot better, it was a turning point for me that, you know, I have a duty and an obligation to raise awareness about this disease, and which is something that I didn't want to talk about for a long time. And I wasn't very open about it. Of course, I publicly, you know, announced, and but I wasn't open about it. And I guess that was, you know, lack of confidence. And also, I'll talk about it. And I guess for me now, that's why it's important going forward in a potentially, hopefully, a Labor government in 2023. That I can contribute through my own experience, but also be a lot more understanding. And that's, for me, is being balanced, trying to find some balance, which there's no balance in my life, but making sure I look after my health, that's the number one. But
when you said decisions, what are you talking, political decisions or decisions about your life and your family?
Yeah, I think that I think decisions about I could have traveled, I wanted to travel. I wanted to experience a lot more. But I, as a working class, coming from a working class background, migrant, background, the choices were limited. You had to, go to school, uni, and work and get a good job. And, and aspire for something bigger and better. So I did make a decision to follow that path rather than go through, sort of travel and take some gap years and, and I did, experience, a good sort of uni life and working. But it was myself and my peers went through, very challenging time because we were also responsible for our parents in terms of explaining a lot of things to them, filling out forms, translating for them, interpreting for them. So we weren't just, going through uni. We had other responsibilities.
That takes me to what initially got you involved in politics. I remember when I used to work for you, you just would bring out the most incredible pictures of you at various Macquarie University Labor Club events. And it would be like, I can't remember the particular photo, but you showed me this photo and I'm pretty sure, was it Bill Shorten? There was some young, or maybe Albo. There was plenty of young, just like young people who are now, the leaders of the labor movement. And you're all just like, you're all like having VBs and you're like in some little common room at Macquarie University. What pushed you, what drove you to get involved with Macquarie University Labor Club and the labor movement in general?
Yeah, look, it's good questions. And look, it was Gough Whitlam who, it was a law society thing, and I didn't study law, but
it was
Gough, and we've got this wonderful photo of him and the students, the peers that I went through uni with, and Tony Burke's in the photo, and another friend of mine, Bill Catharis, and Harry Farros, and Ben Way. So you've got people like Ben's involved with Macquarie, very high position. So, we were all, working class kids who were inspired by Gough, but he was invited as a guest of the Law Society, the Macquarie Law Club. And so I was a bit of a hanger-oner, but with my involvement, it came from school. So, I was involved with Students Council. I went to Kingsgrove High and I was involved with Students Council and we were trying to buy blinds for a bunch of our rooms. And, we got we wrote to the 2SM at the time and we got on and they came to our school.
2SM is the radio station. Yes, 2SM in Sydney.
Is the radio. But at the time, 2SM was like the hot 40, the top hot 40, it was a pop music.
So it's like you wrote to like Carl and Jackie O and you were like, we need blinds for our school.
Oh, they're not that old. They're not that old. But it was I remember they came in and they had a school disco and we raised some money for the blinds. And so that kind of, it was a taste of what is possible, what you can do. And, Kingsgrove High, we were school in the suburbs. And I remember we had Nick Greiner came to our school. He was the premier at the time. And all the teachers made us wear these badges, so there was a massive anti-Greiner, there was a massive blue between the teachers and the Liberal government at the time. So, so I guess those teachers, as well as, seeing my parents going through what they were going through, it was a period of time where we had a Hawke government, We had Hawke and Keating. There were changes to the Australian economy. There was the, you know, floating of the dollar. You had a lot of manufacturing going offshore. And so I saw that impact, that manufacturing going offshore. I saw that impact my mum, people like my mum, who were in her, you know, mid, late 30s, who then couldn't get a job. They were on the scrap heap. And that were tough days, really tough days.
And so how did that translate from where in your career did it pivot from you as a worker, aware of the Labor Party, aware of the Labor movement, to you joining the Labor Party and getting involved?
I think there was a point, I can't give you the exact time, but I think there was a point in me when I was about 12 or 13 and my mum was trying to find a job, and she would get meet her every Saturday. They'd pick up, my mum and my dad would pick up the Sydney Morning Herald, and they would ask me to go through the positions vacant, and we would be looking for cleaning or cook jobs. And so then I'd have to ring up and make the appointment. And then I remember we went to a pub in the Shire. We caught the train, went to a pub in the Shire so my mum could be the housekeeper, the cleaner. And I remember her being interviewed, and the guy was really rude to her. And I just felt so, I felt like really sorry for her. And, you know, I had that feeling of it was not, it was humiliating for this woman, you know, who's trying to, you know, bring home, you know, a bit of money to help the family and, you know, pay the mortgage. And then she was humiliated, and it was discriminatory as well. So I guess at that point, that feeling, that fire, that really, it really fired me up, and I didn't know what to do. And I guess, you know, going through high school and students council and all that, I think the real, I guess for me, that real time was I worked at Sydney Airport, and there were a lot of women like my mum. They weren't getting paid one of their allowances, and I joined the liquor trades union. And I remember we went off on strike because we wanted the right allowances to be paid. And then I met people like Tony Burke and Maurice Yemmer, and got involved in the Labor Party. And Paul Keating was I went to a barbecue that Tony had organised, and Paul Keating was there. And I think it was in between his first challenge. It was in between the first challenge and the second challenge. And yeah, and then I joined the party, and I was completely inspired by Keating and what the Labor Party can do for people like, just, you know, people like me.
How did the path to the upper house play out? What I mean, I think that's the elusive thing, particularly to young women. Like, it's amazing seeing people like yourself in who are obviously so passionate, and I think a lot of young people would look at parliamentarians like yourself and think, wow, I'm really glad that there's a woman advocating for us in parliament. But I think the elusive thing is, how do you go from just like being someone with passion, with fire, who wants to make change, to actually being an upper house member?
Look, I'm very inspired by young people who are engaged in politics more than ever, and they don't get their news, you know, from just TV. And particularly with COVID, there has been a real engagement with politicians, particularly wanting to know what's going on with COVID and the disruption in people's lives, you know, whether it's education or just going out nightclubbing. Like, you know, you've got 18, 19-year-old people who want to go out dancing and going out, and they haven't been able to go out, you know. So that's a big change in young people's lives. And I think I think there are a lot of people who are engaged. I think we need to see more. I'd love to see more young people involved in politics and in political life. It's not just joining the Labor Party. There's a whole lot of political parties, and as part of our robust democracy, I think being engaged and involved, you don't have to join a party. You can join your local bush care group, or, you know, the local country women's association, or there's a whole lot of organizations. And I think we've seen a lot more volunteering. There's a lot of environmental groups, youth environmental groups, and people really, young people that I come across care about education. They want to see that there's a future both in jobs and both in the environment. And, you know, I think that's absolutely critical. And the other thing too, that I think people like Cassandra, you know, who's 11 and a half, and she's a school leader, and, you know, for her, it just doesn't make sense, like Aboriginal reconciliation. Like, for her, it's a no-brainer. Like, for our young people, like, it's a no-brainer. Why, you know, why haven't we recognised our, you know, Indigenous brothers and sisters in the Constitution? Like, she asks me this all the time, and it's like, yes, of course, you know. So there's an expectation from that generation, we have to do better. We have to do better. So, and I think for women, like getting to the upper house, I mean, you know, I had no political connections. I don't come from a political party. You know, I'm like working class migrant girl from the suburbs, and absolutely dedicated and committed, you know, to public service and the Labor Party. And, you know, working through, I got involved working through, you know, the union movement, representing people, and, you know, an opportunity arose, and you can never pick your time. So you can't go, okay, I'm going to do all of this, and then in 20 years' time, I'm going to do this. And you know, there's opportunities that arise, and I came in, I was appointed because there was a vacancy, and I had a one-year-old child and a five-year-old child. So, and we need to make it accessible for people of, you know, all ages, of, you know, whatever background, and to be involved in politics.
Let's talk New South Wales Labor. You mentioned it's been a while in opposition. I often joke. I was doing a podcast the other day about personal finance, of all things. I just love these guys. They're like young guys who talk about finance and investing, and I think it's so important for young people to be empowered about that sort of stuff. But I was doing their podcast, and I was explaining my political background, and I joked that I'd never seen the government seats, because, you know, when I joined the Labor Party in 2011 in New South Wales, it wasn't a crash hot year, and we have been in opposition for a very long time. So it's no secret that New South Wales Labor has been going through a bumpy period, for lack of a better word. What do you think is the path forward to rebuild New South Wales Labor and to be seen as a contender by voters?
Look, Alicia, I believe that the wilderness years of 2011, where the Labor Party, New South Wales Labor, was decimated at the polls. And in fact, when you look at other parties across Australia over the last 10 years, whether it be Queensland Labor, whether the WA Libs at the moment, where we thought, you know, we were completely decimated and a historical loss in New South Wales, where in the lower house we had 20 members of parliament. And in fact, when you look at WA Libs and in Queensland Labor 6-7 years ago, where it was not decimation, like it was just absolute devastation. So, you know, we had those 20 Labor MPs and a handful in the upper house, and we had purpose and intent, and we had no choice. And as one of the world's oldest political parties that was founded by working people, we had to rebuild step by step, and we had to prove to the people who, the unions, for example, we had to rebuild the relationship and the trust with union members, and then going forward, you know, with the community and then with the business community. And we had to demonstrate that by building that trust and building back those relationships. And those things and those relationships take a long time. And then, you know, we had to be, and as you know, Alicia, when you were working for me, that it was nonstop. We had to just drive across New South Wales week in, week out when Parliament wasn't sitting, and we had to demonstrate just our basic credentials, you know, that we are worthy of the people's trust. And, you know, we would talk to the people, and as you know, I had a lot of a couple of seats that I had to look after in the Hunter because we had been completely smashed in the Hunter. And we were, yeah, we were, at, you know, completely smashed in the Hunter. And what I found was people just wanted to explain their situation for us to advocate in Parliament, you know, get out there, be seen, and talk about what we would do for working people, working families, put some ideas on the table. And that took a long time. It took a long time. And that was, and I think that model, we tried to replicate again. You know, we won a handful of seats in 2015. And then unfortunately we didn't win in 2015, but we were able to have a reasonable opposition. It was a very, very difficult task, you know, very difficult task. So my, at the moment, as you know, that it's been a challenging, few weeks, and, I'm hoping that, you know, there will be a resolution, very soon. So,
are you going to give me your hot take on the leadership?
Do you think it will go to a rank and file ballot?
I think that we went through a rank and file ballot. It was the first time that we went through that in 2 years ago after the election. We've had, you know, terrific leaders, but look, I think, you know, at this point in time, we need a change. We need, you know, a fresh change, and you know, I'll let you know now that I'll be supporting Chris Ninnis. And I think that, you know, having known Chris for a very long time at a local level, but not only understands, you know, understands the institutional foundation of what the obligation is of the Labor Party, but I also, you know, believe that all the parts of the labor movement can work together to advance, you know, people's lives. And, you know, people are moving out to Greater Western Sydney. We've got to look at making housing more affordable, provide a choice, but also, you know, providing a whole lot of solutions. And, of course, for education and health is a key to a, you know, better life.
What do you think is if you were to point to sort of one thing in New South Wales that you think that the government isn't doing well at the moment, what would that be for you? What do you think is the number one thing that needs to be addressed?
I think health is you know, let me say that I have praised Dr. Kerry Chant, who is our chief medical officer. He's done an extraordinary job. And, of course, you know, the people in Department of Health and our nurses and our doctors and specialists and, you know, and our contact tracers. And, you know, these are protocols that have been set up, you know, during Labor, you know, those pandemic protocols. Because if people remember in the early 2000s, we had the SARS, and you know, there were a whole lot of other potential pandemics that were happening at the time. So I think that the state of the hospitals, and at the moment there's a rural health inquiry, and there have been, you know, hundreds and hundreds of submissions have been lodged, and you've got, you know, a lot of country hospitals that don't have doctors. You've got, you know, the tea ladies who are holding newborn babies. You've got nurses having to run to Coles to buy Band-Aids. I mean, that's fourth world conditions. And, you know, there's in my local area, you know, in Canterbury, for example, we've got a hospital that needs to be redeveloped, hasn't been for 25 years. And you've got thousands of development because the government green-lighted development that shouldn't have been green-lighted. And we're in a situation where we've got a health infrastructure deficit. So we're not seeing that coordination. And I think that, you know, there are many gaps in our health system. You've got, you know, we need more paramedics. We need more nurse care. And the government has capped wages. So you've got very limited wage increases. And that was done, you know, you remember, Alicia, back in 2011, and we fought tooth and nail, you know, for 4 days, you know, where the parliament stayed open for 4 days to have this historical debate, you know, to stop this wages cap and let the IRC deal with you know, an independent umpire. But so it's been pretty, you know, pretty devastating. But I think that that's the number one issue for me.
So if I won't keep you too much longer, because, you know, we heard at the beginning of the episode what a busy woman you are. But I just wanted to ask you one last question, which is, for young people listening to this podcast, what is your biggest piece of wisdom that you can give someone who, you know, watches politics, finds it interesting, wants to be more engaged? What's your biggest piece of advice?
Just get active, get involved, you know, if you're involved in local, whether it's environmental issues, whether it's advocating very strongly for women. And we've seen across Australia, you know, some phenomenal young women who I'm very proud of, who are coming forward and, you know, putting forward their views, but also they're changing the course of history in our nation by raising these issues. And so, you know, my advice is get involved, get out there, reach out to your local female MPs. Doesn't matter if they're busy, but, you know, even ask them to, if you want to do work experience or come along to a meeting and get to know people and get to meet people. So, yeah, that's my piece of advice, but get out there.
Thank you so much for joining me, Sophie. It's been a joy, and it's also just been so great to catch up.
It's so good. I'm so happy Thank to you. See you. Well done.
Thank you so much. In the House and in the Senate is recorded on the land of the Whadjuk people. This land was never ceded. It always was and always will be Aboriginal land. If you enjoyed this episode of In the House and in the Senate, please jump into your podcast app, subscribe, and give me a quick rating and review. This will help the podcast reach more people, and I will personally be incredibly grateful. Also, be sure to head over to the podcast Instagram at In the House in the Senate, where I'll be sharing content from our guests, throwbacks to my time in staffing, and resources to help you get more involved in the political system. You can also follow my personal account at alicia.aikenradburn. Thanks for listening, and speak to you next week.
Bye-bye. Goodbye to Luke. Bye.
Next question.
See ya.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.